And now, for the show reflecting on classic radio, Hollywood 360, with your host, Carl Amari.
He was like a god walking amongst mere mortals. He had a voice that could make a wolverine purr, and suits so fine they made Sinatra look like a hobo.
This your place, Carl?
Yeah, what do you think?
Really? It's really awful.
But I have a lot of things that are on order. You know, credit trouble.
Pay more attention to your schoolwork and listen to the radio.
You always listen to the radio.
It's different. Our lives are ruined already.
The Whistler.
This tape will self-destruct in 5 seconds.
Hello, everyone. I'm Carl Amari, and this is Hollywood 360, the radio show that presents the best in classic radio. This time, it's part two of The Great Gildersleeve, starring Willard Waterman from 1953. Then, Criminals Beware, or Feel the Sting of the Green Hornet from 1952. With me, as always, is my co-host, Lisa Wolf. What's up, Lisa?
Hey, Carl.
Did you enjoy the first portion of The Great Gildersleeve?
I do. I don't listen to your brother. I think The Great Gildersleeve is great.
Well, you know what? I have something that you will like then.
Maybe the second half.
The second half.
That's
the conclusion.
Good.
Right now, we're going to go back to April 8th, 1953. This is called Leroy's Club Takes Over, the conclusion of The Great Gildersleeve.
Well, when the great Gildersleeve insisted that Leroy be pals with the mayor's son, he didn't realize the mayor's son would become pals with Leroy's girl. But Leroy can be pushed only so far, and he begins to push back.
How do you like these boxing gloves, Bertie?
Leroy, what you gonna do with them?
You won't say anything to Unc?
Cross my heart.
Well, Freddie Terwilliger's been asking for it, and he's gonna get it.
You gonna punch the mayor's son?
Right on his stuck-up nose.
Boy, do you know what you're doing? Your uncle works for the mayor.
So what?
If you hit the mayor's son in the nose, you're the same as slugging the breadwinner below the belt.
Yeah, but Freddie's got it coming. You should have seen him take Babs right out of Mr. Peavy's and leave me flat.
He did?
He can't do that to me, and neither can Babs. I'm going to give her a chance to drop Freddie, and if she doesn't, I'm going to clean his clock.
What's he going to be doing?
I'll be ready for him. All I need is somebody to spar with. How about putting on the gloves with me, Bertie?
Me?
Yeah, come on. Put up your dukes.
Boy, a lady don't put on boxing gloves. A lady uses a rolling pin.
Now, I'm going to sharpen up my old 1-2 and take them on.
Leroy!
Uh-oh, here comes Unc. You hide the gloves while I go out and talk to him.
Okay, I'll put them in the bread box.
Oh, Leroy!
Come on, Unc!
My boy.
Yeah?
Peavy told me about what happened at the drugstore.
Oh, that.
Yeah, I'm sorry Freddie just walked off with Babs.
That's okay.
That was very rude of the mayor's son, I must say.
That's okay.
I guess you didn't even get to use my charge account at Peavy's.
I used it.
Good. Don't let this worry you, my boy.
I'm not the one who has to worry.
Yeah, I suppose Babs is attracted to Freddie because he's a little older than you are and a little larger.
He can be cut down to size.
What's that?
Be seeing you.
All right, be seeing you. I have a feeling that boy isn't telling me everything. Bertie!
Any attention, Miss Gildersleeve?
Bertie, do you know what Leroy is up to?
Leroy?
My nephew, Bertie.
Oh, him.
Yeah. I know something's going on, but Peavy wouldn't tell me anything, and Leroy wouldn't tell me anything. Now you pretend you don't know anything.
I do?
I'm going to get to the bottom of this if I... Hey, are these shoelaces hanging out of the bread box?
Shoelaces?
Bertie, how did they get there?
Well, could be the bread man ran out of string and tied the bread with the shoelaces.
Bertie, you're covering up something. I better look in the bread box. Boxing gloves.
Well, what do you know?
All right, Bertie. How did it happen?
Mr. Gildersleeve thinks the bread man brings bread and he comes home and finds the boxing gloves in the bread box.
How did it happen?
Yes, sir, Mr. Gildersleeve thinks the bread man brings bread and he finds boxing gloves in the bread box.
Ready?
Mr. Gildersleeve, when you came home, you know what you found in the bread box?
Yes, Bertie.
That's right, you found boxing gloves in the bread box.
Well, I'm not going to get anything out of Bertie. Where did that Leroy go?
Well, this is it. I'll just tell Babs it's Freddy or me. She can choose between us right now. If it's me and Freddy starts coming around, I'll sock him. If it isn't me, I'll really sock him.
Why, Leroy.
Yeah.
How nice to see you.
Yeah?
Come in.
Okay.
Sit down, Leroy.
Well, I didn't come over to sit down.
Well, what did you come over for?
Well, I've been thinking. And wondering, too.
Yes, Leroy?
I'm not going to beat around the bush. How was the movie?
Well, you know how I feel about Farley Granger. He was fab. Simply fab.
How was Freddy?
Well, Freddy was very nice to take me. We waited for you.
I didn't show up.
Is that why you came over? To apologize?
Apologize? I came over to see if it's him or me.
Oh, Leroy, you sound so serious.
I am serious. Who'd you rather be with, him or me?
Well, that depends on who I'm with, him or you.
What do you mean?
I don't know what I mean. Sometimes I don't understand myself.
Yeah?
Maybe I should see a psychiatrist. I just like the boy I'm with. When I'm with them.
That's silly.
I like you now, Leroy.
You do?
And when I was having a moron's ecstasy with Freddy, I liked Freddy.
Yeah?
And in the movie, when Freddy went out to get some popcorn and left me alone with Farley Granger saying, "Darling, you're mine alone," that was simply the end.
Gosh.
And then Freddy came back with the popcorn, and somehow I forgot all about Farley.
What did you like then, the popcorn?
Oh, Leroy.
Well, I guess I'd better go.
Oh, I don't want you to go, Leroy. I think this minute I like you better than anybody.
You do?
Oh, excuse me while I answer the phone.
Sure. I'm in. Now I won't have to punch Freddy in the nose.
Hello? Oh, hello, Freddy. No, I'm not doing a thing.
How about that?
Next Saturday? Oh, I'd just love to go to the matinee with you.
Gosh, I was going to ask her.
Go steady with you? Oh, Freddy.
That does it. I gotta punch him in the nose.
I wonder what Leroy is doing out there in the garage. Say, he's skipping rope.
That's enough rope work, Leroy.
Okay, Bertie.
What's this?
Now slip on the gloves and punch the bag a while.
Is Bertie coaching him?
How's it, Bertie?
Hey, Leroy's pretty good.
Now bring one up from the floor, Leroy.
Okay.
He nearly knocked it off the hook.
That would have taken care of Freddy.
Freddy?
Now, wind up and let him have that bolo punch.
You wait a minute. Stop the fight.
Oh, hi, huh?
Uh-oh. I just remembered something in the oven.
Yes, yes. Leroy, what's this about punching Freddy?
Well, he asked for it, huh? I tried to be friends with him, like you said, but it didn't work. I'm going to take the gloves and hunt him down.
You'll do no such thing. Popping Freddy isn't going to settle anything.
It is if I pop him hard enough.
Young man, you and Freddy will talk this thing over like little gentlemen.
Aw.
I want you in my office at 10 o'clock in the morning, and I'll ask Freddy to be there.
Why don't you let me handle this my way?
Because your way is the wrong way, my boy.
Oh, for corn's sake. If he wasn't the mayor's son, I'll bet I could pop him.
Young man, the fact that I happen to be water commissioner and the mayor happens to be my boss has nothing to do with it.
Nearly 10 o'clock, Unc. Where is the little stuffed shirt?
Now, Leroy, just have a seat.
I bet he's home talking to Babs on the telephone.
Good morning, Gildersleeve.
Well, Mr. Mayor, good morning.
Hello, Leroy.
Hi.
I just popped in to see how our boys are getting along.
Fine, Mr. Mayor. The boys were together yesterday afternoon.
Good.
And I'm getting them together again in my office this morning.
Splendid.
In fact, it's hard to keep them apart.
Well, I feel this association with Leroy will do Freddie a lot of good, Gildersleeve, and I'm leaving everything in your hands.
Well, thank you for your confidence, Mr. Mayor.
Good day, Gildersleeve. Goodbye, Leroy.
Goodbye, Mr. Mayor.
Come on.
Now, Leroy, you see how important this is to Mayor Twilliger?
Yeah, but if he thinks I'm going to run around with that Freddie...
Well, good morning, Freddie.
Hello.
Hi.
Sit down, Freddie.
What's this meeting about? Let's get it over. I've got a date. Hey, that bath is a cute dish, Leroy.
Let's get on with a meeting.
Well, let's sit down, everybody.
I'll take your big chair, Commissioner.
I'll sit in my chair, Freddie. You sit over there with Leroy.
I don't want to sit with Leroy.
Okay, sit on the floor.
Now, see here, boys. There's no reason why you shouldn't get along. And I suspect both of you are at fault. I've already talked to Leroy, Freddie, and now I have a couple of things to say to you.
You're kidding.
Yesterday, you offended Mr. Peavy in his drugstore, and you took advantage of Leroy's hospitality.
Commissioner, are you telling the boss's son what to do? You're living dangerously.
No, Freddie, let's be courteous.
Oh, I know what this is all about.
What?
I took Leroy's girlfriend so the little shrimp comes crying to you.
Crying?
Sure. You got sore at me, so you're trying to get even through your big fat uncle.
Oop.
You can't say that about my uncle. Put up your dude.
Leroy.
Hurry up, I gotta do it.
Now, don't touch me, Leroy Forrest.
Stop running and put up your dude.
Leroy.
My father's right down the hall. Now, stop it.
Ow.
Freddie didn't make it. There they go down the hall. Yeah, I wonder if Leroy realizes what this could mean.
That'll do, boys. That'll do.
Uh-oh. Here comes the mayor.
Gildersleeve.
Yes, Mr. Mayor.
Do you know your nephew struck my son?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Freddie will have a black eye.
Well, I didn't see it happen, but...
Oh, you should have seen it. Leroy led with the left and crossed with the right. Beautiful.
Oh?
This is just what Freddie needed. A regular boy like Leroy to cut him down to size.
Well.
Gildersleeve, how do you raise a fine boy like Leroy?
Well, mostly I do a lot of worrying. Folks, this is Gildersleeve again. Good night, folks.
The Great Gildersleeve is played by Willard Waterman. The show is written by John Elliott and Andy White and is partially transcribed. Included in the cast are Walter Tetley, Lillian Randolph, Stanley Farrar, Barbara Whiting, Tommy Bernard, and Dick LeGrand. Musical compositions by Jack Meekin. This is John Heaston saying goodnight for the Kraft Foods Company, makers of the famous line of Kraft quality food products. Be sure to listen in next week and every week for the further adventures of the Great Gildersleeve.
Tonight, play You Bet Your Life on NBC.
And that's The Great Gildersleeve, April 8th, 1953. Leroy's Club takes over, starring Willard Waterman. Also in that cast, we had Walter Tetley, Lillian Randolph, Mary Lee Robb, Richard LeGrand, Tommy Bernard, and Stanley Farrar, sponsored by Kraft. As heard on NBC, Kraft, that was your company, huh, Lisa?
I used to own that company.
Yeah.
But
no,
I sold
Lisa
it
worked for Kraft for a long, long time.
I did. Well, not a long, long time.
Over a year. That's
right.
A long time when you're only 18.
That's
like you
true.
Are.
It's I mean, an 18th
that's 1/18 of your life. See? I did the math.
You are good.
Yeah. So what did you do for Kraft?
I worked for Kraft Philadelphia brand cream cheese.
And you never ate the cream cheese, though, right?
I still haven't. It just isn't my cup of tea.
Yeah. All right. Well, maybe the Green Hornet is.
There you go.
That's coming up after these words.
More Hollywood 360 after these important messages.
Hi, this is Sarah Knight Adamson. I'm the national film critic for the website sarahsbackstagepass.com. I'm a member of the Broadcast Film Critics Association in L.A. and a voting member of the Critics' Choice Film Awards. Coming up next, you'll hear a film review of a movie that's playing near you. Won't You Be My Neighbor? is a documentary offering an in-depth look at Fred Rogers, the man behind the PBS children's program Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. He influenced generations of children by his calm and caring and loving nature. Director Morgan Neville focuses on the career of Fred Rogers. We learn about his early years of his music college classes, his studies to become an ordained minister in the Presbyterian Church, and his family life with his wife and two sons. Let's take a listen.
He had a singular vision of kindness and love.
Love is at the root of everything. All learning, all relationships, love or the lack of it. Children have very deep feelings, just the way everybody does.
It's an eye-opening portrait and a loving tribute to the cardigan-wearing man who liked us just the way we are. Here's another clip.
Won't you be my neighbor? Well, I suppose it's an invitation. It's an invitation for somebody to be close to you. The greatest thing that we can do is to help somebody know that they're loved and capable of loving.
The bottom line, I'm all in. 4 stars out of 4. This outstanding film serves as a role model for all adults. You will be in awe of this honest and sincere man who saw a way to help nurture and teach our children for over 30 years by simply turning on the TV.
Won't you please, please won't you be my neighbor?
See you next week.
Now back to the best in classic radio on Hollywood 360.
Welcome back. This is Hollywood 360, coast to coast on 180 stations. And we are going to tune in to the Green Hornet in this hour. And, you know, the Green Hornet was an interesting radio show. And, in fact, when it went to TV for one season, you know who played Kato, Lisa?
Bruce Lee.
Yeah, that's right. Bruce Lee, Mr. Karate himself, was Kato on that series.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Did you ever watch The Green Hornet?
I'm way too young to
on
have watched
television?
It while it was...
It was in the 60s. It was
exactly.
Like 1967 or 68.
That's what I'm saying.
One season.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I loved it. It was great. All right. Well, it's time now for The Green Hornet, October 8th, 1952. This is called The Changing Alibi. It stars Jack McCarthy. Here's part one of The Green Hornet.
X-Tree, X-Tree, Sentinel X-Tree, now the most refreshing drink in the world, Orange Crush, presents the Green Hornet. He hunts the biggest of all game, public enemies who try to destroy our America. With his faithful valet Kato, Rick Reed, daring young publisher, matches wits with the underworld, risking his life that criminals and racketeers within the law may feel its weight by the sting of the Green Hornet. Now ride with Rick Reed in the thrilling adventure of The Changing Alibi. The Green Hornet strikes again. Dan Menden used a legitimate shipping business to mask his criminal activities. He had been questioned and arrested by the police many times, but he had never been brought to trial. Witnesses were loath to testify against Menden, and the reason was the menacingly persuasive powers of Menden's lieutenant, Joe Anacosta. But Anacosta had developed ideas. That evening, he entered the outer office of Menden's place of business near the waterfront. Fritzy Miller, one of Menden's huskies, alone in the office, looked at the wall clock.
All right, Joe, you're 10 minutes late. When you called the boss today, you said you'd be here at 7.
So what? Is Dan inside?
Yeah, go right in.
Hello, Dan.
So you finally got here,
Yeah. And now that I'm here, Dan, I'm not going to beat around with the words. I'll give it to you straight. I'm not your boy any longer.
Huh? What are you talking about?
Dan, I've decided you ought to retire. I'm taking over.
Got the kidding, Joe.
I'm not kidding, Dan. From now on, I want the take from the Shippers Protective League, the Dock Loader Society, your 6-for-5 loan racket, and everything else you've been running.
You're crazy. Get your hands up, Joe. Don't reach for your gun.
Well,
you're not smart, Joe. You should have had your gun pointing at me when you came in here. You ought to know I'd outdraw you. Now, wise guy, get over against the wall.
No. You'll kill me.
You'll kill me. Give me that gun. You.
Cliffy Miller in the outer office heard the struggle. He leaped from his chair and crossed the room. Shots rang out before he reached the door.
Hey, boss, what the...
Dead. You killed Joe.
Yes, I killed him. It was either me or him. He asked for it and he got it. Cliffy, the first thing we'll do is get rid of the body.
I know just this spot, boy. Just this spot.
Jip O'Gray and his wife Aggie were walking along Water Street. The street, except for an occasional automobile passing on the bridge overhead, was completely deserted.
You know, Jip O, this is the time I like it best here.
Yeah, me too. No trucks on the street, nothing doing on the docks. No sneaking cops there.
Jip O, get over here, quick.
Hey, you going nuts? What are you doing? Crouching down behind those barrels.
Jip O, look down there. At the end of Pier 58. Near the park car. You see them two?
Aggie, they're dragging something.
Something? That's a body. Jippo, they're lifting it up in their arms.
It's a man. They've thrown him into the river. Aggie, it's murder we're looking at.
Don't move, Jippo. They're turning around looking into the car. And when they come off the pier, they left the past this spot. If they see us, they might kill us. There he is, over
there. Oh, they're gone. Aggie, did you see their faces?
No, I was too scared to look. But, Jippo, when they passed, I saw part of the number on the license plate. The last three numbers. Jipper, what's the matter with you? Didn't you hear what I said?
Yeah. I heard you, Aggie. Aggie, I don't need to know what the license number was. I recognize one of the men who was in that car.
Jipper, you don't mean
it. I do too, Aggie. She a big shot like him.
Who was he? What's his name?
Never mind. I'm not telling you.
Why aren't you telling me? I'll hear who he is when you tell the cops.
We're not telling the cops, Aggie. For me, all my life, cops are in trouble. Listen, Aggie, if we don't tell the cops, we'll get enough money to keep us for the rest of our lives.
Why, you're talking loony.
I'm not, Aggie. That fella I saw in the car is a big shot who likes to keep out of trouble. If I tell him I saw him here, he'll pay me to keep quiet. You go on home, Aggie. Got some business to look after.
That's the first portion of The Green Hornet. More after these words.
Now back to the best in classic radio on Hollywood 360.
Now back to The Green Hornet.
Dan Menden and Cliffy Miller had returned to Menden's office, where Menden called his fiancée, Maxine Paris, and told her to meet him at Palmyra's Chop House. He also called Rocky Palmyra, the restaurant owner, and gave him certain instructions. Then he prepared to leave the office and go to the alley, where Cliffy Miller was cleaning the death car. Suddenly the door opened, and Jip O'Gray stood there.
Hello, Mr. Menden.
Who are you? How'd you get in here?
I came in the back way. Your pal was fixing the car. I didn't want to disturb him. So I walked right in.
Then walk right out. I don't give handouts to tramps.
I saw you a little while ago, Mr. Menden. You and the other fella.
Huh? What are you talking about?
You know what I'm talking about. I saw you and the other fella a while ago down on Pier 58.
You did, huh? Go on, tell me more.
Jip O'Gray told of the scene he'd witnessed, but made no mention of his wife being with him. He ended.
And so when I saw who you were, I thought maybe you'd rather pay me than have me go tell him the cops.
So that's your game, is it? Blackmail, huh? Who else was with you when you had this pipe dream?
Nobody.
Good. Did you finish with the car, Clifty?
Yeah, boss.
Then take care of this would-be shakedown artist now.
Sure, be glad. Well, I give him a treatment.
No, Clifty. For works.
Hey, Just a minute. You said the works. That means you're going to kill me.
How'd you guess the tomato knows? Now turn around and start moving out that door fast.
Shortly after, Dan Mendon sat at a table in Palmyra's chop house. Seated with him were Maxine Paris, his beautiful and overly blonde fiancée, and Rocky Palmyra, hard-bitten owner of the cafe. Mendon was talking low and earnestly.
Because the police know that Joe worked for me, they'll probably ask me questions. That's why I want to have this story set about Maxine and me coming here at 7 o'clock and staying until after midnight. It's all right with you, Rocky?
Well, sure, Dan, anytime. I get a couple of down of the waiters and the waiters to go along with the story.
Good. You have your story straight, Maxine.
Yeah, sure. You called for me at 6:30 and we got here about 7. That's easy.
That's just too bad about Joe, Dan. He's the one who kept everybody in the line for you. Oh, you're going to miss him.
Yeah, so will I. He's sure good rubber. What can we be dancing?
Shut up, Maxine. Rocky, tell the waiter to bring our steaks, will you?
Oh, sure, Dan, sure. They'll be right here.
Gippo Gray's bullet-ridden body was found early the next morning in a woods on the outskirts of the city. Hours later, as Gippo's body was being taken to the city morgue for identification, another body was found, that of Joanna Costa. Michael Axford of the Daily Sentinel, assigned to the seemingly unimportant murder of the still unidentified tramp, was on the telephone seconds after word of Anacosta's death was received.
Sentinel? And Mike Axford, put me through to the city desk in a hurry. But when I'm finished, transfer me to Reed's office, will you? That's a good girl. Hello, Gunnigan. Listen to this. They just found Joe Anacosta, full of bullets, floating in the river off of Pier 58.
Central X-Tree, Joe Anacosta killed.
Right here.
Here you are, sir. X-Tree, X-Tree, read all about it. Anacosta murdered. Here you are, sir. Central X-Tree.
Rick Reed, young publisher of the Daily Sentinel, after Axford's telephone call, went to the office of his friend, Police Commissioner Higgins, one of the few persons who knew that Reed was the Green Hornet. When Reed met Higgins, the latter was on his way to the Homicide Bureau.
Come along, Reed. Perhaps something's breaking on the Joe Anacosta case.
As Reed and Commissioner Higgins neared the door leading to the Homicide Bureau, Michael Axford emerged from another door. He stopped when he saw them.
Reed, I just phoned the paper and told them about that old guy they found murdered out near the city line this morning. They've just identified him by his fingerprint.
Oh, who is he, Axford?
An ex-convict, Gippo Gray. He's got a wife who lives down on Front Street, and I'm heading there now to see her.
The detectives are going too, Axford.
Oh, sure, Commissioner. They've gone already. Well, I'll be seeing you later, Reed.
Right, Axford.
Well, here we are, Reed. Oh, Lieutenant Mahoney, you wanted to see me?
Yes, Commissioner. Look at these photographs, sir. We just got them back from ballistics.
Lieutenant Mahoney, ballistics expert, showed the enlarged pictures of two bullets with identical markings on each.
One of them comes from the body of Joe Anacosta. The other's from the body of a tramp found dead out near the city line.
Gippo Gray? The man Axford just told us about?
That's the one, Commissioner. There's no doubt about it. Both men were killed by the same gun.
Oh, that's most interesting. I wonder...
Reed, if you don't mind, I'd like to hold back that information for a while. If it doesn't get into the papers at once, it'll make it easier for us to follow up on it.
Well, the Sentinel will print nothing till we get the go-ahead, Commissioner. You have my word.
No, thanks.
However, there's no objection if I follow up on the information, is there? On my own, I mean.
I'm sure there'll be no objection at all, Reed.
And I'm going down to Front Street at once to see the widow of this Gippo Gray.
I'll go with you. The Lieutenant, will you get me the Gray address?
Yes, sir.
I think I'd like to speak to the woman myself.
When Reed and Commissioner Higgins arrived in the dingy tenement apartment of Aggie Gray, the woman was sobbing bitterly after recovering from a faint brought on by the news of her husband's death. Axford, standing behind the detective who'd been questioning her, whispered to the new arrivals.
I guess you know about it already, huh?
About what?
She and her husband saw two men throw what must have been Anacosta's body into the river.
And I knew he'd get into trouble not telling the cops like I wanted him to do. And the terrible part is he didn't tell me the name of this big shot who he recognized. That's who it was that killed him. I knew it. But I got that ass three numbers on the auto license plate. Maybe that'll help you to find Gippo's murderer. Maybe that'll help you to track
him. I'm Police Commissioner Higgins. Tell me, what were the last three numbers on the license plate?
Well, let me see now. Yeah, I have them. I remember them now. 934, as I were. 934, I'm sure of that.
Thank you. Reed, let's get out of here in a hurry before the license bureau closes for the day. We'll start them checking on all license plates ending in 934. The license bureau kept a man overtime to check on all plates that ended in the numbers given by Mrs. Gray. Then when these were listed on sheets of paper, Commissioner Higgins and Reed began to check off the names and addresses. It was Reed who saw the name that brought their work to a halt.
Hey, Commissioner, look at this, will you?
Yeah, let me see. Daniel James. Reed. Dan Menden. His car ends with those numbers. Great Scott, you think...
I think there's no need to look further. Anacostia was Menden's right-hand man. Menden's office isn't too far from Pier 58 or from the house where Gippo Gray lived.
We checked on Menden's alibi. He and his fiancée were at Palmyra's chop house from 7 o'clock on last evening. But Reed, Menden told me he'd be home this evening. I think I'll have men question him at once.
Wait, Commissioner, please. May I suggest that you don't question Menden for at least an hour?
Yeah. Why should I wait that long?
Because you may be sure he'll be ready for you with an alibi. Now, Commissioner, suppose someone should enter Menden's home within the next hour without his knowing it.
But Reed...
Suppose you called him by telephone, say about 8:30, told him you were checking a new angle that might involve him.
Why should I do that? Put him on his guard.
Yes. It might even move him to do and say things before the police got there. Things that might be overheard by the person who entered the house unknowingly. Something the police wouldn't be permitted to do by law.
You mean...
Yes, Commissioner. The Green Hornet has thought of investigating Dan Menden before this. Now might be a good time to start.
As police commissioner, I have no comment to make. As a friend, I can only tell you that Menden's home is at 1100 River Terrace. And again, as commissioner... You may want to know that the police will not call Menden before 8:30.
Reed hurried to his apartment where he outlined a plan to Cato, his valet friend and the first person ever to know that Reed was the Green Hornet. Cato led the way to Reed's bedroom and gave him the Green Hornet's mask and gas guns.
Well, here you are, Mr. Bitt. You say you're in a hurry, so we go now.
Cato, that's Menden's home on the corner. We'll park the Black Beauty among those trees near the river.
Weird door, Cato. Have the gas gun ready while I use my special key. That does it.
Dan Menden and Clifty Miller had been playing cards in the Menden living room, unaware that for more than half an hour, their every word had been heard by the Green Hornet. He and Cato, who was also masked, stood outside the living room door, listening intently. Menden rearranged the cards in his hand, then placed them on the table.
Jim! I schnatted you this time, Clifford.
Oh, you're lucky.
Wait till I answer this. Hello? Why, hello, Commissioner. It's the police commissioner.
What?
What's that? You don't say. What is the bar? Yeah. Goodbye, Commissioner. There's something about this I don't like. Why should the police commissioner himself call and tell me he has a new lead which involves me?
He told you that?
Yes, but that's all. I can't figure the angle.
Hey, do you think maybe Rocky Palmyra or one of the waiters in the police messed up your alibi story? Maybe the cops learned you weren't at the chop house at 7 o'clock.
If that happened, I'd know about it by now. Wait till I check with Rocky. Hold it. Hello, Dan Menden. Let me speak to Rocky, huh? Well, he's not. How soon will he return? Oh, good. Tell him to call me then. I'll be waiting.
Not in, huh?
No, his wife ate at the place and he's driving her to the theater. He'll be back soon.
What about your girl, boy? You think maybe they started questioning her again?
Why should they? Unless... I'd better check.
Yeah, those cops can rattle anybody if they try hard enough.
Are you...
Well, no offense or nothing, but Maxine's not smart.
Shut up. Like... Maxine, has anyone tried to check your story about... No? Well, I don't know. Hey, what was that?
Hey, it was out in the hall, boss.
I'll see. Maxine, hold on a minute. Something's wrong. Clifty, get your gun ready.
Menden placed the telephone aside, took a gun from the top drawer of his desk, and followed Clifty, who had gone into the hallway. He could hear Clifty coughing and gasping as he reached the doorway.
Clifty, what's wrong? What's happened to you?
Menden.
Hey, what?
Don't use that gun.
You stop.
Hey, your shot's wild. Here's gas.
Hey.
He's out. Thanks for grabbing his arm. Shot just missed me.
Well, good thing I close to him.
Keep an eye on them, even though they're unconscious. I must go inside and complete Menden's phone call.
Hello, Maxine.
I'm finishing this call for Dan. Maxine, things have gone wrong. If the police should ask about last night, tell them you made a mistake.
Yeah, that's right.
Say you and Dan got to Palmyra's at 8:30, not 7. If you do that, everything will come out the way it should.
Now, don't worry. Just stick to your story. You'll be seeing Dan soon. Goodbye. Hello? Rocky?
Dan told me to take the call for him. Look, he and Clifty are in a jam. He'll have to change that story about getting to your place at 7 o'clock.
Yeah, I know. But he says he wants you to change it.
Say that he and Maxine arrived there at 10:30.
And Maxine set with her story. Don't worry.
Well, that's up to you.
Goodbye.
Yeah. Now, one more call, Mr. Higgins. And for the last one.
After a long talk with Commissioner Higgins on the telephone, the Green Hornet returned to the hallway and joined Cato.
Let's get to work on these two and wake them up. I'm taking one last chance to learn the truth.
What is it?
I can't tell you, but the commissioner knows. He and his men will be ready at the right time and right place. Start slapping him.
I'm due to revive soon anyway.
Hey.
Minutes later, Dan Menden and Clifty Miller regain consciousness.
Come on, snap out of it, Menden. Wake up and listen to me.
I'm awake. What? The Green Hornet?
Yes. Now, when Jippo Gray was killed, only one witness was taken out of the picture. It was someone else who knows what happened last night. Someone who was on Pier 58.
What are you talking about?
I say there's a witness still alive. Menden, right now the police are checking again on that alibi you set up with Rocky Palmyra and Maxine.
How do you know that? Oh, yeah, I was talking on the telephone when...
I got you away from it, yes, I hung up.
Now, listen, Hornet. Why did you come here? Why do you tell me all these things?
Because when Anacosta was killed, I made up my mind to cut myself in on your rackets, Menden.
Hey, that's what Joe tried to do.
That's why he was killed, I know that now. But, Menden, I want you to stay out of jail. That's why I'm telling you that Jippo Gray's widow saw what happened last night, too.
His widow?
I'm telling you this for what it's worth. The police aren't bothering her right now. I have a way of knowing that. Don't ask me how.
You mean she's alone?
Yes, and will remain alone. Unless she has visitors.
What's this got to do with me?
When you're in the clear, I'm cutting in on you. I told you all I intend to tell. I took your gun and left it inside. We'll leave you now, my partner and I.
The Green Hornet and Cato turned and sped from the hall and ran to the rear door. Menden and Clifty, still groggy but faintly comprehending the story told by the masked man, looked at each other.
Clifty, let's check on his story. First I'll call Maxine and check with her. Maxine, this is Dan. Listen, I couldn't finish that call before because... What's that? The police are there. What? What? You told them we got there at 8:30. 8:30, but I told you... Hello, who's this? Detective Murray, you say? Clifty, we're getting out of here fast.
What's happened, boss?
That feather brain has changed the story. The cops are at her place, and she told him we got to Palmyra's at 8:30.
Well, you better call Rocky, make sure he doesn't change his story.
Yeah, you're right. Hope they didn't get to him. Now, let me speak to Rocky. This is Dan Menden. Rocky, Dan. Listen, Rocky. The cops are there, too, you say? Can you talk? What? 10:30? You told him...
What now, boss?
That mallet head. He was smiling, I think, when he said he told the cops I got to his place at 10:30. He sounded as if he thought he was helping me. And Maxine with her 8:30. Crypto, your alibi smashed.
Yeah, but like the Hornet...
I know. Without an eyewitness, it's going to be hard to pin anything on me. Crypto, we're going after that eyewitness before the cops get to her.
Mrs. Jippo Gray answered the knock on the door of her tenement flat. Two men pushed their way inside.
Mrs. Gray?
Yes.
Oh, we're not going to waste time. Look, did you ever see us before?
See you?
Yes. Someone told us you think you may have seen us at one time or another.
Like last night on Pier 58.
Oh, so you were the two in the car. I saw you throw the body into the river.
Boss. Now, look, lady, you better come with us. We don't want to kill you like we killed your...
You killed my husband. You
killed... Yeah, we killed your husband. Now, take it easy, Mrs. Gray, or we'll kill you, too. Stop it.
We can't waste time or take chances. One more death on my hands isn't going to matter. Step aside. I'll use my gun. I'll let her have it right now.
Hey, the cop!
Oh, come get me now. Oh, I was afraid maybe you weren't outside the window like you said you'd be.
We had men follow up the stairs, too.
Get me a doctor. I'm shot.
But you'll die in the electric chair, not from a bullet in the arm. We've been keeping Maxine Paris and Rocky Palmour in a car downstairs, Mendon, waiting for you to come. They broke your alibi, but you supplied the clincher.
How did you know I'd come here? The Green Hornet must have told you. Yeah, he's the one.
Commissioner, you hear that? It was the Green Hornet who called you and told you. What about the Green Hornet? He was in on this too, wasn't he?
I can't say that he was, actually.
I'll bet he was. Double-crossing his partner, Mendon, that's what he was doing. Putting him on the spot so he'd have things to himself. That's what he was up to. Sure. Look, Commissioner, it had to be the Green Hornet that knew all these things. It surely wasn't Britt Reed. No, I'm betting the Green Hornet was behind everything that happened.
Read all about it. Mendon, gang in jail. Clifty Miller indicted. That's Electri Pitman.
That's the Green Hornet story for today. This program is a feature of the Green Hornet Incorporated. Created by George W. Trendle. Produced by Trendle Campbell Muir Incorporated. Directed by Charles D. Livingston. And edited by Fran Stryker. The part of the Green Hornet is played by Jack McCarthy. This copyrighted feature originates in Detroit, and all characters, places, and incidents used are fictitious. The Green Hornet is brought to you every Wednesday and Friday at this same time by the most refreshing drink in the world, Orange Crush. Next Friday, listen to the Green Hornet again in the exciting story of danger entitled Keys to a Robbery. And now till Friday, this is Fred Foy saying so long from Orange Crush. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
And that's the Green Hornet from October 8, 1952 with The Changing Alibi starring Jack McCarthy. It was sponsored by Orange Crush as heard on Mutual. And Fred Foy doing the announcing on that. And Fred Foy, Lisa, was my original announcer.
I remember.
On my one of my first radio
that
shows I ever did.
That was before we combined efforts.
Yep, Fred Foy. What a great guy. And you heard the great Flight of the Bumblebee theme music there by Rimsky-Korsakov. That is such a recognizable, operatic kind of tune. That was their theme song on the Green Hornet. Hope you enjoyed that. Let's take a break. Then it's more here on Hollywood 360.
More Hollywood 360 after these important messages. Now back to the best in classic radio on Hollywood 360.
Next time, Orson Welles stars in The Lives of Harry Lime. You won't want to miss that. Then it's part one of the Abbott and Costello show from 1945. That's next time here on Hollywood 360. We'll see you then.